Good afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Hall of Fame in the Chicago Cultural Center at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. My name is Chuck Shaden, and we're delighted to... Thank you. I don't look like I sound, right? Everybody says, gee, you don't look like you sound. I said, well, neither do you. You know, we talk to people on the telephone, we hear people on the radio, and then when we meet them, if they don't look like they sound, sometimes you're disappointed. Very often people say to me, you don't look like you sound, I thought you'd be much older. And I hug them and kiss them. Gee, this is wonderful. But that's because I deal with an art form that is mostly gone, but certainly not forgotten. Certainly not forgotten by those of us who are here today. And many of us here today never actually had the opportunity to hear the radio programs from the Golden Age when they were broadcast live. But we've had the opportunities to have an acquaintanceship with them. And of course, in the 1970s and the 1980s, we had a wonderful experience of listening to what I was calling at that time New Time Radio, which was, of course, the CBS Radio Mystery Theater. And that is what we're going to be doing for you this afternoon. One of the better shows, and they were all great shows, but one of the better shows from the CBS Radio Mystery Theater. A couple of bits of information before we get started. First of all, no recording devices are permitted this afternoon in the theater. If you have a VCR, if you have a videotape recorder, please don't use it. Don't use an audio tape recorder. These are professional actors, as I mentioned earlier today, and they have donated their services to the Museum of Broadcast Communications Radio Hall of Fame so that we might be able to continue the work of the Hall of Fame. And, of course, you have helped us by purchasing your tickets for this special event. We are recording this event on our museum videotape machines, and after a period of somewhat editing, a videotape of this event will be available in the archives of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, so you'll be able to see that. Now, eventually, there will be a means for you to get a tape recording of the broadcast that we're about to do. This is not being broadcast live today because I would not stand to have anything on the air opposite me on 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Also, it's being recorded, and it will be broadcast sometime in the near future, and we will let you know when it's going to be broadcast. But tapes of it will also become available, and we will let you know when those tapes are available. Now, if you want to take photographs of the activities up here, we have no objection, but the sound of your camera clicking does pick up the very sensitive microphones. So if you can resist the urge, try not to take a photograph. If you can't resist the urge, go ahead and take the photograph, but just be a little environmentally sound and only take one instead of two, if you wouldn't mind doing that. The actors following the broadcast will be here to answer questions, and I'll be down in the audience with this roving microphone so you can ask a question of any of the actors who are here this afternoon or the director, and we'll be sticking around for a little while after that. When that's all over, our cast is going to go into the outer lobby, and there will be tables out there, and if you want to get an autograph or shake a hand or say, gee, you know, I listened to you not so long ago and enjoyed it, they'd be happy to see you at that point. We'll just have to let them get out of the theater and to the tables, and then you can leave following that. Again, in that area or this area, there is no smoking. I would like to mention that today you are going to be hearing, probably for the first time, a little story about the Radio Hall of Fame interwoven as commercials through our recreation. And a number will be given, a 1-800 number will be given, where you would have the opportunity to join the Radio Hall of Fame and help us continue to produce programs such as this. and many other things that we have in mind to do in the future. And I might add that a member of the Radio Hall of Fame will be able to get, first of all, advance notice for a program like this, and also would be able to come on board for somewhat of a discount to the general public. So there is a value to joining the Radio Hall of Fame. And part of the membership in the Radio Hall of Fame will be to you become automatically a member of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, and you get all of the benefits of becoming a museum member. If you are already a member of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, poof, you're already a member of the Radio Hall of Fame, and you will get some information to that effect in the not-too-distant future. We have a tremendous cast today, people from coast to coast, people from the West Coast, person from the West Coast, person from the East Coast, and lots of people from the Midwest, from Chicago. I'd like you to I'd like to introduce some of the members, all of the members of our cast. We have a man who is very well known, whose voice is very well known in Chicago. He is an actor, a narrator. He is the creator of Word Jazz, which you hear on WBEZ every Monday night at midnight. He scared the daylights out of us, narrating Faces in the Window on television, and he's doing an awful lot of continued good work. You hear him on about 9 million commercials in the Chicago area. I'd like you to welcome Mr. Ken Nordine. Ken? In the good old days of radio, I could hardly wait to rush home after school to turn on the Captain Midnight! Didn't care much for the Ovaltine. But I loved Captain Midnight, and I always identified with Captain Midnight's sidekick, Chuck Ramsey. I mean, not only was he a kid like me, but he had the same first name. And I sure love that. And we have a man who appeared on that program as Chuck Ramsey. He's an actor on a variety of radio programs, dozens and dozens, hundreds of shows over the years, Mr. Jack Bivens. Jack? Another member of our cast is the owner of Streeterville Recording Studios in Chicago. He's an actor, he's an announcer, a narrator. He is a man of many voices and dialects. He's Jim Dolan. Jim? This morning when High Brown came in, he said, well, we have, of course, cast all the roles. And I said, I've only cast one role for you. And he said, who's that? I said, the lone female in the script. You didn't have any competition whatsoever. But you have no competition, I might add. She is an actress who appeared in a great many radio shows throughout the glory days of radio and continues to be on the air today in her Midday with Sandra Gare program on National Public Radio and WBEZ. She also had interesting roles in the great days of radio on Jack Armstrong, Sky King, Gangbusters, The Eternal Light, and the Hallmark Playhouse, Sandra Gare. If you are among those folks who just love listening on Saturday night to WGN and the Mutual Broadcasting System Chicago Theater of the Air, you know that they had a dual cast. They had a cast of singers, and they had a cast of actors. Well, many Chicago personalities appeared as the actors in the roles on the Chicago Theater of the Air. The next performer is one who was regularly heard on the... You wonder how I got a job in radio, don't you? Who was regularly heard on the Chicago Theater of the Air, on Bachelor's Children, and on the Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters. He's an actor, an announcer, and a narrator, Mr. Russ Reed. Fine radio show coming out of Chicago in the great days of radio was the Hall of Fantasy. Our next actor this afternoon is a man who was an actor, a writer, producer, director of that show and of many, many other radio shows throughout the years, Mr. Dick Thorne. We have gone to practically no expense to bring these people to you today. And that is because they are all donating their services. They, too, believe in the projects that we believe in. They have a great love for the radio days. And the man who has come in from California, from his home in Hollywood, California, to be the star of this Mystery Theater broadcast today is a man whom many, many people remember as the star for a great many years opposite Barbara Luddy on the First Nighter program. He was also the star of The Thin Man and hundreds of other radio shows, Mr. Les Tremaine.
I hate to say it, Chuck, but it's over 30,000 radio shows.
That's many, many, right? One of the important elements of radio in those glory days, and of course in our broadcast today, is the man who does the sound effects. We're very fortunate in having with us a man who, when he came in this morning, was greeted as the last living sound effects man in the United States of America. But he's a man who worked for NBC in Chicago for a great many years, 46 years, as a matter of fact, starting in 1933. So he was there through all those great radio days, especially when so many of the programs were coming out of Chicago. He worked sound effects on Backstage Wife, Silver Eagle Mountie, Little Orphan Annie, Tom Mix, Ma Perkins, and Fibber McGee and Molly. Now you can imagine the role he may have had on that Fibber McGee and Molly show. Would you like to show us the sound effect that you used to do when they opened up that closet on Fibber and Molly?
All right.
Go ahead. It's Kurt Mitchell. Kurt Mitchell. And now to direct the Mystery Theater, we have a man whose career goes way back into the radio days, and his contributions to the golden age of radio were such that helped make that golden age golden. He did so much to entertain us. One of the most outstanding programs he did in the great radio days had one of the greatest openings of all times. Close your eyes now and listen to the opening of the program that he produced, directed, and created.
Good evening, friends. This is your host to welcome you through the creaking door into the inner sanctum. Come in, come in. I've been reading my fan mail. Huh? Oh, sure, I get lots of it. Delivered in a hearse every morning. One lonely heart writes, "Despite your sinister voice, you strike me as a fine gentleman and a homebody. I am companionable, good-natured, unmarried, and I've been hardly dead a year. Won't you please exchange photographs, signed, Lonesome?" Did somebody say the lady spook out of turn?
How well we all remember the inner sanctum of radio's great days. This man worked on Dick Tracy, The Gumps. He directed our star today, Les Tremaine, in The Thin Man. And when we all thought that radio was gone forever, he came up with this program.
A CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents to the sound of suspense, to the fear you can hear. Welcome to the world of terrifying imagination.
Welcome to the fear you can hear. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Hyman Brown.
very difficult to say what I feel because Chicago has been a very special part of my life. I never lived here, but most of my career began here. Back in 1932, I came to the Chicago Tribune Daily News Syndicate and arranged with a glorious man called Arthur Crawford to buy the rights to the Gumps. We were going to do a comic strip for Corn Products Refining Company, a little family vignette each day. They bought half-hour radio time. In those days, the client bought the time and then put the shows on. And they bought from 2 to 2:30 each day, and the first 15 minutes was poetry, because in the 30s, you had Poets Gold. Poetry was very much a part of the radio programming scheme. And they had already set the first 15 minutes with a young fledgling actor who was going to read poetry. His name was Orson Welles. And I came and I said, all in the family, that's what we were, the Gumps. It was a typical American family, not nearly as politically oriented or socially oriented, but there were little vignettes every day. And while I was buying the rights to the Gumps, I also asked about Dick Tracy. And then some years later, I asked about Terry and the Pirates. And there was a wonderful, wonderful lady here at a firm called, an advertising agency called Blackett, Sample & Hummert. I don't know if any of you remember. It is now Dancer Fitzgerald Sample. That lady was Mrs. Ashenhurst. She's a legend. She's still alive. And she came out of Chicago to New York, and I met her. The gods smiled. And in 1933, I did the first daytime romance. They weren't called soap operas. It was the daytime romance, Marie, the Little French Princess. And it was a wonderful, wonderful five-day-a-week series, which she let me produce, cast, do. Those stories can go on forever. We'll leave that after the drama. I would like to read to you what I feel your applause has done for me and what I feel about radio, because it is so much a part of my life. I have now devoted all of it to the spoken word. Of all the forms of theater, radio drama commands the most effective stage. No medium, not theater, not film, not television, has more sheer space in which to achieve the basic goal of drama, telling a story. Theater is bounded by the bare boards and the footlights and flats, film by the wide screen, television by the comparatively small tube. But radio plays itself out in boundless space, the listener's mind. We in radio have always called it the theater of the mind. We proudly trace our lineage clear back to the primitive campfire, the tribal storyteller. As these passers on of tribal legend, of heroic adventure, of the mysteries of nature, told their stories by word of mouth, so do we. We do not show you, we tell you. And we leave the trappings to your imagination. Take you anywhere, everywhere, put you in glass slippers or seven-league boots with our props or animation. Unconcerned, unhampered, uninhibited by sets, lights, locations, costumes, the task of memorizing lines. Take and retake. We make you believe everything because it is happening before your mind's eye. We can do anything. Harpoon you a white wheel, let you ride with the musketeers, bury Pompeii, and even if the story demands, raise Atlantis from the sea. And all with what the Creator used in the very beginning of all things, the Word, the spoken Word. The visual media, television, seemed to me to have failed the audience in one crucial respect. More often than not, they violate what I like to call the private image. Hamlet's castle may look pretty authentic up there on the stage. On film, the real thing may be the backdrop. But if you've cherished inside your own mind your private image of the unfortunate prince, the image you must watch perforce may not correspond to your own, or worse, even violate it. Listening, Hamlet can appear to your mind's eye not as the casting director decided, but as you demand. I've been doing radio for more years than I care to admit. It has been my pride and privilege to take nothing but a page of words, lovingly and skillfully set forth by dozens of fine writers, unashamed of their medium, and bring that page to life with a handful of tools. First of all, the human voice, the voices of actors who can play on emotion as if it were a Stradivarius on the musical ear. Next, of course, the mechanics of the craft, the sensitive microphone, capable of dealing with Juliet's whisper or a mob's roar. And finally, the remaining elements of the radio craft, sound and music. And what have you? Aside from music itself, the only art form you can enjoy with your eyes closed, looking inward, seeing what you are hearing. Ironically enough, we are the nation where radio drama was born, a great deal of it here in Chicago, and yet the only one where dramatic radio is now all but non-existent. Happily for me, back in 1974, when radio had been dreamed long dead and television held living room sway, I was able to persuade the president of CBS Radio, Sam Diggs, to believe as I did that radio could make a comeback. I went on the air with Mystery Theater, a series of hour-long dramas heard 7 nights a week, 350 stations. Radio dead? I stayed on the air for 9 years, 350 stations, as I said, a cumulative audience, 5 million people each week. Still, 9 years is a long time for any show, even during the medium's heyday, and so we went off the air. Why ultimately did we die? We had 3 acts, each running some 13 or 14 minutes. I needed the time to tell a story uninterrupted by commercials, develop characters, but that cut into the number of commercials we could accommodate. And a news segment running only 2 minutes could allow many more commercial interruptions and more dollars. Simple as that. And no other networks were interested. Music and news, rock and commercials, but drama, who needs it? Nevertheless, when only a few years ago, the Voice of America sought to tell the rest of the world through English language broadcasts the drama of our American past, stories of men and women who wove the fabric of our national life, they didn't turn to television for a zillion-dollar star-studded series. They turned to radio, to me, to be honest. Who needs it? I asked that a moment ago. There is something to radio drama that satisfies the soul of the actor and the writer. Let's face it, telling a story with nothing but words for the writer, creating a character with nothing but your voice for the actor, is not the easiest of assignments. And for me, there is the joy of creating with these actors around the mic, the tape recorder going, the stopwatch keeping its eye on discipline, and out of the silence, George Washington crosses the wilderness as a 21-year-old unknown to achieve his first command. No wigs, no false beards, no long shots, close shot, zoom, pan, follow spots, retake, nothing but the spoken word, the voice, and some sound in the background. The cost, compared to the equivalent on the screen or the tube, peanuts. And speaking of peanuts, forgive me the metaphor, but television is playing a shell game with you, its audience, concentrating on the shell, the trappings, the so-called production values. Translation, lots of expensive rental cars and furniture, costumes, and the inevitable cut to the chase. And forget the nut, forget the meat, the core of drama, of entertainment, the story. We in radio don't need stunt drivers and the police to clear streets for the chase. All we need is a proper soundtrack, and the chase takes place right in your mind. But the shell game is cheating its audience in a fashion even worse. It is cheating the watcher out of his own creativity. In television, little of anything is left to the imagination. Everything is blatantly spelled out. One would think accordingly, and many have said so to me, that a generation has grown up sitting and staring at pictures that has forgotten how to listen. Not so. Proof, fan mail. A mother writes to tell me, "Thank you for the story about the little girl and the unicorn. You have given back the world of fantasy to my daughter." Only radio drama can do that. Fantasy is something the child, the world, still cannot do without. More fan mail. Letters telling me, some of the disenchanted viewers, so many of them young people, are listening. An 8-year-old youngster wrote to me saying, "I love to watch radio." Another made it even more poignantly clear, "I see the picture better," she wrote on radio. And then, I suppose, that is what it's really all about. The inward vision is sharper. The picture is clearer because the mind for itself is clearer. The new and special delight in creating the characters, their look, their identification with the listener, their direct appeal to that private image is a form of entertainment our children had never found sitting in front of the tube. Another letter sums it up perfectly. A little girl writes, "I like the story about the white whale better than anything I ever saw because I could pretend that was me chasing him." No longer watching somebody else doing something on a screen, today's young discoverers of radio drama, when they can find it, are discovering they can be there on the deck with Captain Ahab, riding bareback behind Heathcliff on the moor, begging for more with Oliver Twist, disappearing down the rabbit hole with Alice. Name me, if you can, one little boy or girl who has not begged over and over, "Tell me a story." A child who does not specify stereo or color or production values or animation, just, "Mommy, Daddy, tell me a story." And from there, the next step, "Read me a story." And after that, the next and most important step to the three magic words that will fill out the empty spaces in living throughout a lifetime: "I can read." Only to that particular form of magic, reading for oneself, will I yield. Next to that, on the scale of word magic, is radio drama. And that's why I so happily want to be a part of you this afternoon. And so that is my credo, and that's what I will live for you in the next years and as long as I can. And now we will reproduce for you the CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents... Come in. Welcome. I'm Ken Nordine. Fear, it may be said, is a malignancy which, once the seed is sown in the human soul, spreads like a voracious and all-consuming fungus throughout the psyche, smothering it at last in death. No one knew this better than the justly celebrated author Robert Louis Stevenson. No one has ever expressed it more vividly, more compellingly, more frighteningly than he did in his story, The Suicide Club.
The next card to Iris, the Ace of Hearts.
Oh.
Next card to Mr. Malthus, the Spirit. spade, Mr. Malthus, but only the jack of spades. This card to Mr. Victor Harris. Why, it's another spade, Mr. Harris. The ace of spades. Tonight you are the lucky one, Mr. Harris. Tonight you die.
Mystery drama, The Suicide Club, was especially adapted from the Robert Louis Stevenson classic for the Mystery Theater by George Lowther, and stars Les Tremaine, with Jack Bibbins, Jim Dolan, Sandra Gare, Kurt Mitchell, Russ Reed, and Dick Thorne. We'll be back shortly with Act One.
This recreation of the Mystery Theater is a project of the Radio Hall of Fame, which recognizes and showcases contemporary talent from today's diverse programming formats, as well as the pioneers who shaped the medium during its infancy. Founded by the Emerson Radio Corporation in 1988, administration of the Hall of Fame was assumed by the Museum of Broadcast Communications in September of 1991. The Radio Hall of Fame is headquartered in the Chicago Cultural Center on Michigan Avenue, where it houses the world's finest radio archive of more than 49,000 broadcasts from the 1930s to 90s. A state-of-the-art radio studio available to stations throughout the country for local and remote broadcasts, and an exhibition area which highlights many of the Radio Hall of Fame inductees, such as Edgar Bergen's Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer Snerd, Fibber McGee and Molly and their notorious hall closet, and Jack Benny and his famous vault. The Radio Hall of Fame recognizes radio's rich heritage while keeping an ear to the future. And now, the CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Compulsion. What is it? What is it within most of us, perhaps all of us, that compels us to do this or that? What spurs the compulsive gambler to bet again and again, aware always that in the end it can only bring him to ruin? That was a question Victor Harris often asked himself, but could never answer. Until a certain fatal night, when he met a man who called himself John Smith, and found himself having a drink with Smith at 2:30 in the morning in a fashionable Manhattan bar.
Well, your health, Mr. Harris.
Yours, Mr. Smith, I think you said?
As good a name as any other.
Why did you invite me for this drink, Mr. Smith? It isn't customary, you know. More often than not, the strangers one meets at poker games remain strangers. It's best that way. Still, you asked me. Now, why?
Well, you interest me, Mr. Harris. In fact, you intrigue me.
Oh?
The last hand we played, everyone else had dropped out, leaving just you and me. I admired the way you played. I admired your nerve. More than anything else, I admired your coolness, your indifference when you last... when at last you lost. $37,000, Mr. Harris. $37,000.
Your admiration is misplaced. Cool? Indifferent? Why not? $37,000 is nothing to me. I'm a millionaire, Mr. Smith.
Who are you?
Several times over.
Well, then losing that much would mean little to you, if anything at all. In fact, I'm surprised you bothered to play. Where's the thrill in winning or losing?
There isn't any. Not for me. Not anymore.
Then what point is there in playing?
None. None whatsoever. Gambling of any kind bores me, but I do so because, well, Mr. Smith, I'm what is called a compulsive gambler.
I see.
No, you don't, really. Unless, of course, you're a compulsive gambler, too.
No.
Then you can't possibly understand the hell of it. No more than you can understand the torment, the unceasing personal torture of the alcoholic, say, or the dope addict. With them, as with me, the thrill has long been gone. Boredom, unbearable boredom, has set in. But the compulsion remains. It's hell, Mr. Smith. There's no other word for it.
What would you say if I, John Smith, were to tell you that I can change your boredom into a thrill the like of which you've never experienced before?
Well, now you intrigue me.
Such was my intention.
Go on.
No, I mean every word. I can promise to replace your present boredom with a thrill. A constant daily thrill that will last you the rest of your life. Now, there's a price tag, of course.
How much?
We can discuss that later.
All right. But now, what's the nature of this thrill you're talking about?
I'm talking about what might be called the supreme gamble, Mr. Harris.
The supreme gamble?
Yes.
Sounds like a matter of life and death.
It does, doesn't it?
Is it?
You're a gambler, Mr. Harris, and a compulsive gambler at that. I think you'll be willing to gamble an hour or two of your time to find out. The truth is, I'm positive you won't be able to help yourself. You must find out now.
That's dirty pool, Mr. Smith.
Maybe. Maybe not. In any case, here's my card. I'll be expecting you at this address tomorrow night, 7:30 sharp.
Suppose I don't show.
Why, then, you'll never know what the supreme gamble is. And you'll go on being bored.
Yes?
My name's Harris, Victor Harris. I believe Mr. Smith is expecting me.
Yes, he is. Come in. This way, Mr. Harris. Mr. Victor Harris, sir.
Oh, thank you, Lucas. Good to see you again, Mr. Harris. We'll join you in a few seconds, Lucas. In the game room.
Yes, sir.
Scotch, I think, Mr. Harris.
Thank you. I admire your taste, Mr. Smith. This is a beautiful room.
Oh, thank you. Antiques and paintings are my hobbies. I confine myself to the 18th century, as you can see.
Beautiful. Just beautiful.
Your drink?
Thanks.
To the supreme gamble, Mr. Harris.
The supreme gamble? Whatever it is.
We'll come along and find out. Bring your drink. This way. Now, this, Mr. Harris, is the game room. In this room, every night, Saturday and Sunday excepted, the supreme gamble takes place.
But what is the supreme gamble?
First, tell me what you see.
A room. A large room. Tastefully and expensively decorated in 18th century style. That large round table covered with a green cloth. Looks like a card table.
That's what it is.
The people in evening dress. Men in black tie, women gowned, all drinking champagne.
Anything else?
Well, nothing I can see. Except, some of them are playing chess, backgammon, others reading, some talking to each other.
Nothing else, Mr. Harris? You notice nothing else?
Why, no.
Their faces. Look at their faces. Look closely. Well, what do you see?
Why, their faces, they're all of them excited about something, I can see. Yes, they all look as if they're expecting something very exciting to happen at any moment.
They are, but not at any moment. Not until 8 sharp.
Well, what happens at 8 sharp?
That you'll find out at 8 sharp. In the meantime, let me introduce you to one or two members of our club.
Oh, it's a club?
Oh, yes. Very select club. Oh, Mr. Malthus, may I introduce Mr. Harris, our new member?
How do you do?
Oh, how do you do? Correction, though. I'm not a new member yet.
He will be, Mr. Malthus. He will be.
See you a minute, Director.
Of course, Lucas. Excuse me, gentlemen.
Lucas called Mr. Smith, director.
Yes, we all do. He's the director of our little club.
I see. Mr. Melford.
Yes.
What kind of club is this?
You don't know.
No.
Then, why are you here?
To tell you the truth, I'm not exactly sure, except, well, Mr. Smith, your director, promises I'll experience the thrill of my life, the supreme gamble, he calls it.
It is that, Mr. Harris. And our director will keep his promise. I promise you.
You, Mr. Malthus, is that why you're here? And all these people? To take the supreme gamble, I mean?
Yes. You might put it that way.
In other words, you, these people, you're here because you like to gamble.
Oh, no, 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 not at all. I don't in the least like to gamble. No, I'm here because I'm a coward.
A coward? What do you mean?
Just that. I'm a coward. I'm afraid of...
Well, I see you two have become acquainted. But I'll take our new guest away from you now, Malthus. I see Iris Lawn sitting all by herself as usual. Come along, Harris. I'll introduce you.
Wish me luck tonight, Director.
Oh, I do indeed, Malthus. I do indeed. Iris, let me introduce our latest member, Mr. Victor Harris.
I'm not a member, Mr. Smith.
Director. Call me Director from now on.
No offense, but I'll call you what I please until I am a member, if I am.
I doubt if you will be, Mr. Harris.
Why, Iris, what do you mean?
Just what I say. He doesn't look like one of us.
Oh, but he is. In a different way, for a different reason. I'll leave you two together. I've got to prepare a fresh deck of cards.
Well, I don't think I got your last name, Miss...
Miss Iris Thorne.
You said that I don't look like one of you.
You don't.
Well, where's the difference?
Your eyes. In your eyes. That seems to puzzle you, Mr. Harris. Look into my eyes. Look deep. What do you see?
Well, they're lovely.
I'm not fishing for compliments, Mr. Harris. I'm far beyond a feminine desire to be told I'm beautiful.
Oh, but your eyes are beautiful.
What else are they? What else do you see in them?
Sadness. Yes, great sadness. The sadness of...
Of death.
Death.
I'm dead, Mr. Harris. I've been dead for years.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention. It is time. Gather around the table, please. Our director will now deal the cards.
To Mr. Cranes, the Two of Hearts. To Mr. Shaw, the Eight of Diamonds. Mrs. Harper receives the Four of Clubs. Next card to Mr. Burke, the Nine of Spades. Miss Russell this time. Next card to Mr. Wolfson, the Ace of Spades. Since Mr. Morley has already drawn the Ace of Clubs, the game is ended. Mr. Wolfson, Mr. Morley, I will see you both in my office as soon as I've completed my business with Mr. Harris. This way, Mr. Harris. Oh, Lucas, champagne all around as usual.
Yes, Director.
Well, sit down, Mr. Harris. Drink?
Thanks, no. Just tell me. Tell me what this is all about.
You still don't know?
And drop the cat and mouse game. You've had your fun. Those people in there. You're dealing cards. The ace of spades, the ace of clubs. What's it all about?
As I told you last night, the supreme gamble, Mr. Harris. The supreme gamble of life and death.
Meaning what? Exactly.
Meaning that everyone in that room stakes his life 5 times weekly on the turn of a card. Let me explain.
I've been hoping you would do just that.
Yes.
All evening.
Well, now, tell me, Mr. Harris, have you ever thought of committing suicide?
Have I ever? Oh, There may have been times when I didn't give a damn whether I was alive or dead, but no, I've never thought seriously of suicide.
Well, many do, you know. Think of it seriously. You'd be amazed at how many people there are in the world who want to kill themselves but haven't the nerve to do it.
So?
We do it for them.
You?
To put it more aptly, we arrange it for them once they become members of the club, the Suicide Club, we call it. Now, here is your application for membership, all filled out. You have only to sign it.
Wait a minute. Take it easy, Mr. Smith.
Director, if you don't mind. Once you become a member...
I'm not a member.
But you will be, once I've explained about the gamble. Now, think of the gamble, Mr. Harris, the supreme gamble of your life. Think of the thrill of each night, staking your life on the turn of a card. Not a momentary thrill, but one that makes each day worth living because it may be your last. Mr. Harris, think of it. The never-ending thrill of the final gamble. The supreme gamble.
The ace of spades. The ace of clubs.
Simple. Whoever in each nightly deal receives the ace of spades is killed. Everything, of course, is arranged to make his or her death appear accidental.
The ace of spades, the person killed. The ace of clubs...
The one who does the killing.
Well, then, one is the victim, the other his murderer.
Perhaps I've misjudged you. But last night you struck me as a man of the world, a man quite divorced from middle-class morality, a man more than willing, indeed anxious to take risks most people would never take.
I'm afraid I am.
Well, then...
You spoke of the fee.
Oh, a necessary evil, I'm afraid. The club's overhead is high, extremely high. Accordingly, so is the fee.
Which is?
Half your estate. Half of what you owe.
Half?
That may sound unreasonable to you at first, but it all balances out. What I mean is there are members of the Suicide Club who have large estates, vast wealth. But at the other extreme, there are some who... have virtually no estate, no money at all. Miss Lorne, for example, Iris, you met her, practically penniless. She was quite well-to-do when she joined some time ago, but luck, the cards, has been against her. And in the meantime, she has spent everything she had on her habit.
Drugs? She's a drug addict?
Which is why she wants to die. It's the only solution to her problem.
What a shame. She's so lovely. Her life could be so worth living.
But isn't. Not anymore. Well, now, Mr. Harris, I promised you the greatest thrill you've ever had. I promised to cure your boredom with life for the remainder of your life. I'm ready to keep that promise with, as I said last night, the supreme gamble. Sign here.
Well, I...
Yes?
I'd like to think it over. I'm not
You
too
know
sure.
What your decision will be. You're a compulsive gambler, Mr. Harris. Whether you join the Suicide Club now or later, you will join. I know it. You know it. To be bored is to be dead, as you so well know. Why not live a little? Why not sign? Now?
Why not? Yes, why not? Give me the pen, Mr. Smith.
Director, if you will. From here on, call me Director.
Director?
Compulsion, psychiatrists say, is another word for decision. Deep in the very core of his being, a person has made a decision that gambling, drinking, whatever may be ruining his life, is somehow necessary to his happiness. Well, we shall see when we return shortly with Act Two.
This recreation of the TBS Radio Mystery Theater is a project of the Radio Hall of Fame, which each year honors radio pioneers, programs, and personalities. As its name suggests, the Radio Hall of Fame features an impressive roster of radio greats, including Fred Allen, Don Ameche, Jack Benny, Edgar Bergen, Hyman Brown, Freeman Gosden and Charles Carell, Arthur Godfrey, Paul Harvey, Bob Hope, Marion and Jim Jordan, Don McNeil, Edward R. Murrow, and Orson Welles. Radio programs inducted into the Hall of Fame include the CBS Mystery Theater, Grand Ole Opry, Little Orphan Annie, The Lone Ranger, Lux Radio Theater, and The Shadow. Also honored by the Radio Hall of Fame are Major Edwin Armstrong, Lee DeForest, Guglielmo Marconi, William B. Paley, David Sarnoff, and Frank Stanton. Existing radio organizations throughout the United States are invited to share the process of selecting worthy individuals and programs to be honored each year in ceremonies nationally broadcast on a special Radio Hall of Fame network. And now, we return to the CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Bored, weary of a life of compulsive gambling, which has lost its stimulation, Victor Harris, wealthy man about town, has joined the Suicide Club. Other members have joined because they want to end their jaded lives but cannot bring themselves to do so. And so it must be done for them. Victor's reason is different. A gambler who cannot stop himself from gambling, he has decided to take the supreme gamble, his life, on the turn of a card.
Your first night, Harris. Good luck.
I'm not quite sure how to take that, Mr. Director. I'm staking my life on the turn of a card. I grant you I'm a compulsive gambler, but my life? I wasn't quite prepared for anything like that when I came here for the first time last night.
I hope you're prepared now. We play in less than 5 minutes. Why not wander about and become better acquainted with your fellow members?
Yes, I'll do that.
Oh, by the way, it's customary for new members to order champagne for everyone.
Oh? Well, I'll be more than glad to.
Lucas, champagne all around on Mr. Harris.
Yes, Director.
See you at the table, Harris.
Yes. Miss Lawn?
Mr. Harris.
May I join you?
Please do. So you did join.
Even though you said I wouldn't.
I didn't say that. I said you shouldn't. But even when I said it, you had no choice.
No choice?
Once you accept our director's invitation to pay this place a visit, you've had it. There's no turning back. No way.
Why not?
You'll find out. I did.
Well, what do you mean?
He doesn't run this place for kicks, or maybe he does in a way. But what he's really after is your money. And according to the grapevine, yes, we have one here too, you've got plenty.
Well, according to the grapevine, you have none. You're penniless.
Now, yes. I was worth well over $100,000 when I joined almost 6 months ago.
And?
A lot of it, and I don't know how much, I didn't keep count, went for heroin. Of course you know I'm on dope.
Yes, and I'm sorry.
You? Sorry for me? You're hooked as badly as I am on gambling, they say.
Well, I'm afraid that's the truth.
A habit you can't kick, just as I can't kick mine. But about my money, the rest is it. If it went fast, right here.
Well, how?
You just bought champagne for the crowd, didn't you?
Yes.
Well, there are 37 here tonight. That champagne's going to cost you $3,700.
Hmm. He's got his goal?
I wouldn't worry about what he's got. You'd better worry about what he hasn't got.
What's that?
A heart. A soul.
Look, Miss Lawn, Iris, if I may, I made a decision to join the Suicide Club last night. I can make the decision to leave it, too.
Can you?
Well, of course I can. Why do you say...
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention. It is time. Gather around the table, please. Our director will now deal the cards.
The tray of spades to Mr. Dowling. For you, Mrs. Cranes, the four of clubs. For Mr. Malthus, the ace of spades.
I've won! At last, I've won.
Mr. Malthus, remember the club rules. Control, Mr. Malthus, control.
But I've won. This will be my last night on Earth. After all this time, my last night. At the latest, this time tomorrow night, I'll be dead.
Mr. Malthus.
I beg your pardon, Director. I truly beg your pardon.
Let us go on. Mr. Robinson, 8 of diamonds. Miss Feitzen, 2 of spades. Mr. Whalen, 9 of hearts. Mr. Harris, Mr. Harris, your first supreme gamble.
Yes.
What card shall it be, do you think? Here it lies on top of the deck. What shall it be?
Well, it can't be the ace of spades.
True.
Well, what is it?
I don't know. I haven't looked. Enjoy yourself, Mr. Harris. Feel the excitement of not knowing. Live the supreme thrill of wondering, what is the next card?
Turn it.
Why don't I put it aside and draw the others?
Turn the card.
But come, this is what you joined our club for. You were bored, filled with apathy. Gambling had lost its allure. And yet compulsively you played. But now, for the first time in perhaps years, you're again experiencing...
Damn you! Turn it!
As you wish. It's a club, Mr. Harris, the ace of clubs. Mr. Malthus, Mr. Harris, you will join me in my office in 5 minutes.
You wanted a thrill. You got it.
What? Oh, Irish.
You look sick. It takes some champagne. It'll settle your stomach. It's always unsettling when you get the ace of clubs the first time.
What do you mean, the first time?
Some have got it twice, 3 times before the ace of spades.
There won't be any second or third time for me. There isn't going to be a first time. I'm no murderer.
You have no choice.
Oh, yes, I have.
Mr. Harris, we're waiting.
Oh, coming. You look sorry for me, Iris.
I am.
Why?
You're about to find out, I'm afraid.
Be seated, please. You there, Mr. Malthus. Mr. Harris, there. Lucas, be good enough to serve the champagne Mr. Malthus so generously ordered for all tonight.
When shall it be, Director? When is my moment to come? How shall it be done, and where?
Patience, Mr. Malthus, patience.
First a toast. To your death, Mr. Malthus.
Yes. First a toast. To your death, Mr. Malthus.
Yes.
To your very good death. You don't drink, Mr. Harris?
Not to a toast like that.
Mr. Harris, don't you understand? This is a happy moment for me.
Not for me.
Are you saying... But you're not saying you won't go through with your end of things. Please, you're not saying that...
Mr. Harris is saying too much.
I only want to make plain...
Later. Mr. Malthus, your suicide will take place tonight at approximately 10:30. Is that satisfactory?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Good. Now, here are your instructions and a map to go along with them. This straight line represents the Uptown Express platform on the IRT subway at 42nd Street.
Yes?
This arrow indicates the direction from which the Uptown Express train will come into the station. At 11:30 tonight, you are to stand at precisely this spot that I've marked with an X.
X marks the spot.
Yes. Now, the platform will be filled with the after-theater crowd. You will take up your position at this spot and stand at the very edge of the platform. Clear?
Very, very clear.
Well and good.
Only if Mr. Harris obeys club rules, keeps his end of the bargain.
Never fear, he will. Goodbye, Mr. Malthus. And
goodbye.
Godspeed.
And thank you for all you've done.
And now, Mr. Harris.
You'd better get one thing straight right now, Mr. Smith.
Director.
Director. I have no intention of going through with this, now or any other time.
You surprise me. Perhaps I'm in error, but it seems to me that I carefully explained the rules of the club to you before you joined last night, and you agreed to abide by them.
I didn't count on anything like this.
Why not? Everything was clear and above board. Whoever received the ace of spades in our nightly dealing would die. An apparent accident. And whoever received the ace of clubs would kill him. Do you deny that I made that plain to you?
No.
Well, then.
I won't do it. I can't. I'm no murderer.
Of course not. This isn't murder. It's suicide.
Oh, come now.
But I'm serious. When you push Malthus in front of that incoming train...
I have no intention of
please,
pushing...
Let me finish. When you push Malthus in front of that train, you'll not be murdering him. You'll be doing him a service. Like all our members, he wants to die but hasn't the nerve to kill himself. You will simply be doing it for him, and that, as I see it, is not murder.
I see it differently.
That's too bad, Mr. Harris. I'm sorry. But frankly, there's nothing you can do about it.
Oh, I think there is. I'm resigning from your club right now. Goodbye.
Lucas.
Get away from that door, Lucas.
Sorry, sir.
Lucas, I'm warning you.
I wouldn't, sir.
Now, damn it!
Oh, come now, Harris. Sit down and try to act civilized.
Civilized?
Reasonable, then. You made a bargain with me, signed an agreement here at this very desk last night. I promised to recreate for you the thrill in gambling that you had lost. In return, you promised me one half of your estate. I have already kept my promise and, as things now stand, will keep it again, perhaps many times. Who knows when Lady Luck will hand you the Ace of Spades. Now, if I've kept and am keeping my promise to you, why can't you keep yours to me?
So far as I'm concerned, I'm no longer a member here. I've resigned.
You still don't understand. Mr. Harris, no one resigns from a suicide club. No one ever has, no one ever will. I couldn't possibly run that risk.
Risk? What risk?
Of non-members, shall we say, learning about the suicide club and its purpose. It could be very embarrassing, you know.
I won't argue with you any further.
No, you won't. I've had enough of your argument. You know what you have to do tonight. You know where and when.
I won't.
Do it, Harris. For if you don't, I promise you'll wish you had. And as you already know, I keep the promises I make.
Mr. Malthus?
What? Oh, Mr. Harris, you're just in time.
Yes.
The express will be along in a minute or two.
Listen to me.
We really shouldn't be talking together. Just stand behind me, and when the right moment comes...
Listen to me. I'm not going to kill you.
You're not?
I can't.
You must. I can't do it either. What do you think you're here for?
To save you, if I can.
Save me?
You don't want to do this. You don't really want to take your life.
You're crazy. Of course I want to do it. But I can't. I haven't the nerve. You must do it for me. You must.
No. We'll go somewhere and talk.
Talk?
About you. About why you want to die. Maybe if you had the chance to talk things out with someone,
you... Train, you see the light? Far down in the tunnel, it's coming. You will do it, won't you? You will. Promise me you will.
No.
Yes, now. I'm going to stand. Stand like this, edge of platform, with my eyes closed.
I've got to get away from here. Get away.
Excuse me. Mr. Harris.
What? Iris. What are you doing here?
I followed you.
Why?
Because I...
Malthus. That was Malthus. He must have found his nerve to do it himself.
No, Mr. Harris. I did it.
You? Lucas, you shoved
him. The director figured you'd lose your nerve. It happens sometimes. And when it does, I take over. Well, see you and you, Miss Lorne, at the club tomorrow night. 8 sharp, as usual.
You've got it wrong, Lucas. You won't see me tomorrow night or any other night.
You got it wrong, Mr. Harris. If you don't show up tomorrow night, there won't be any other night.
As Victor Harris watches Lucas vanish quickly into the crowd, surely he begins to realize what his compulsion to gamble has brought him to. To what? Why, to certain death, wouldn't you say? I would. We'll be back shortly with Act 3.
This reenactment of the Mystery Theater is a project of the Radio Hall of Fame. You'll be excited to know that now you can join the Radio Hall of Fame. Yes, you can become a part of radio history yourself as you help the Radio Hall of Fame grow into the future. Your membership means your name will be on the 1993 honor roll at the Hall of Fame in the Chicago Cultural Center. And you'll be able to vote in next year's new Radio Hall of Fame members' choice category, where we'll honor one of your favorite personalities in our 1993 ceremony. And, of course, any time you visit Chicago, come see the Radio Hall of Fame. See the real Charlie McCarthy. Open up Fibber McGee's closet. Visit Jack Benny's vault. Or join the studio audience for special Hall of Fame programs from our state-of-the-art studio. Join with us now by calling 1-800-860-9559, where our operators will give you the details about this $30 membership. So if you want to see the best in radio remembered and honored, become a member of the Radio Hall of Fame at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Call 1-800-860-9559 for more information. And now, back to the CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
You. Yes, you, listening to my voice. You are Victor Harris, or depending on gender, Iris Lorne. If you are Victor, you join the Suicide Club for a thrill. If you are Iris, you join because you were sick of life and wanted someone to do for you what you could not do for yourself. Commit suicide, kill you. But whether you are Victor or Iris, you begin to wonder if you've made a mistake. A fatal mistake. Now that it's too late. And so now, Victor, Iris, you are in a secluded cocktail lounge.
Iris, I don't understand.
What more can I say? I've made it plain enough. I followed you, Victor, because I couldn't bring myself to believe you'd kill Mr. Melton.
And intended to stop me if I tried. That's what I don't understand. Why did you intend to stop me?
You won't believe me.
Try me.
I love you. I told you, and you wouldn't believe me.
Well, it is a little hard to believe. We only met last night. In fact, we haven't spent much more than 20 minutes at most in each other's company.
How long does it take to fall in love?
Why, I don't know.
I do. I found out when I met you last night. A second, 2 seconds, however long it took for my eyes to look into yours, that's how long it took. You don't believe me, do you?
Well, I believe you mean what you say, but...
But what?
We're both compulsive personalities. With me, it's gambling. With you, drugs. That means that neither of us is totally in control of ourselves. You love me, you say. I'd say it's just impulse. An emotion you suddenly feel, and can't control. Infatuation. It'll pass.
You don't understand. I never realized there could be such a thing as love before, at first sight. And now I know there is. And I met up with it last night. I love you, Victor Harris. It's as simple as that. I love you.
Well, I'm honored and flattered, Iris. I mean that. But I'm afraid I don't feel the same way about you.
That's all right.
No. It isn't all right. I wish... I don't know what sense in talking about what I wish or don't wish or anything. We're in trouble, Iris. Real trouble. And if we'd better start talking about it is how to get ourselves out of it, if we can.
Do you think we can?
Well, we can sure try. We'd better try. It's that or death. Waiter, check, please.
What are you going to do?
The only thing I can do. Go to the police.
Sit down, Mr. Harris. Miss Thorne.
Lorne.
I'm Lieutenant McPhee. What's your problem?
Well, Lieutenant, it's like this. And that, Lieutenant, that's the whole story.
Uh-huh.
You don't sound as if you believe us, Lieutenant.
Yeah, tell me something, Miss Lorne. How long have you been mainlining?
Mainlining?
You know what I mean. It's written all over you. Your eyes, the long sleeve dress. You pull up that sleeve and let's have a look.
No need. It's true.
Okay. And what about you?
Me?
Yeah. What are you on?
Lieutenant, we came here for help.
Everybody comes here for help, and we help them all we can. far as I can see, you're just wasting my time and the taxpayers.
What I just told you...
Sounds like a pipe dream, a suicide club. I've heard some far-out stories, but yours? It's out of space.
In other words, you don't intend to do...
We'll check it out. But a word of advice.
Yes?
You and her, kick the habit and try to get your feet back down on Earth, huh?
Come on, Iris.
Vic, we've got to go to my place.
We're staying right here in this church until I figure out our next move.
We've been running all day, Central Park, Radio City, and now this church.
We couldn't go to my place or yours. The director, Lucas, they're sure to be looking for us.
I can't stand it. I can't.
You don't have to, Miss Lloyd.
What? Lucas!
Right here in the pew behind you, Mr. Harris. Let's go. The director is waiting. Mr. Harris and Miss Lorne, director.
Oh, come in, come in. I was a bit worried about you. You're late. Only 5 minutes before the evening's deal.
Now look, you creep.
Mr. Harris, such language. From you? I'm afraid you're not yourself. In fact, I'm sure you're not. Going to the police, revealing all about our intimate little club.
How do you know we went
to
the police?
Had a visit today from a Lieutenant McPhee. He didn't mention you by name, but I have reason to suspect you know him. Big fellow, 6'2". Lucas showed him about. I couldn't be bothered. Lucas, tell them what happened.
Nothing happened. I showed him around. Just a private residence.
What else? As you say. What else? Well, now, champagne for you, Mr. Harris, and this for you, Miss Lorne.
I don't want your champagne, and she doesn't either. Do you, Iris?
Why not? Why not? Why shouldn't I? I'm dying for it.
Then here, my dear.
Iris, no.
Victor.
Iris, no, please.
I've got to. I can't help myself. I'm all alone. I've been alone, and I need something to comfort me.
Come here.
Victor, I
come,
don't...
Come.
Oh, Victor.
I'll comfort you, my darling.
How touching. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this since the suicide club opened. It is time for our evening ritual. Come, Miss Lorne, Mr. Harris. Our little game of cards awaits us all. For Mr. Dowling, Five of Diamonds. Mr. Whalen, the Nine of Hearts. Mrs. Lawton, the Ace of Diamonds. Mr. Whalen, the Deuce of Spades. For Miss Lorne, Iris, the Ace of Clubs.
Victor.
Steady.
For Miss Feitzen, the Eight of Hearts. Mr. Hansen, the Ten of Hearts. For Mr. Harris, the Ace of Spades. That ends the play for this evening. Miss Lorne and Mr. Harris will join me in my office, please.
Oh, Victor, I feel sick. I think I must...
Mrs. Lawton, do what you can for her. In my office, Mr. Harris. Well, now, Mr. Harris, it appears that Dame Fortune has frowned on you tonight. With any other member, I'd say she had smiled. But your case is different. Regrettably, you've just experienced the final gambling thrill of your young life.
You arranged it, didn't you?
Now,
you dirty...
Mr. Harris! No name calling, please.
You're not going to go through with this.
Oh, yes.
No, this whole thing is crazy. I don't intend to die tonight, or any other night for a long, long time. I'm resigning from this. Insanity, you call a club. And so is Miss Lane.
Enough. Your instructions are to leave here immediately and return to that elegant penthouse apartment of yours and stay there. And oh yes, if you have any idea of seeking help, such as going to the police or anything of that nature, don't. You'll be very closely watched from the moment you leave. And any attempt to disobey my orders will result not only in your death, but Iris Lorne's as well.
Your instructions. Just how are you to kill me?
Kill you? I could never kill you. You know that?
Yeah, but what instructions have been given you?
To come here and wait. That was all.
Well, that settles it. They're going to kill us both.
What makes you think...
I was followed until I got here. First thing I did was to call the police, or try to. Phone is dead. I had a gun in my desk drawer, and it's gone. They've been here, and they didn't miss a trick. And now, just telling you to wait. Iris, we're trapped.
Oh, dear Lord.
Hang on, and come with me.
Where?
We're going to the police.
But we'll never get there. I was followed here just as you were.
We can give it a try. It's a gamble, but... Well, I just lost.
Victor, what are we going to do?
What can we do?
Don't answer.
Now, that won't do any good. They've got a key, I'm sure. Look, there's just one chance. You answer the door. I'll stand behind it. And, well, Lord knows I'm not much when it comes to fighting, but I can try. Go ahead. Open it.
Thank you, Miss Lorne. I was just about to use my key. May I come in?
I can't stop you, Lucas.
No, you can't. And how about you coming out from behind the door, Mr. Harris? Wouldn't have done you any good, anyhow. You're no match for me.
Might have been worth a try.
Always the gambler, huh?
I wouldn't be in this mess if I weren't.
That's for sure. Well, now, let me tell it like it is. The director has given me his orders, and I'm here to carry them out. Everything can be done fast and easy. If you cooperate.
And if we don't?
Don't give me a hard time, Mr. Harris, please. Now, this is the way it's going to be. You got the ace of spades tonight. Miss Lorne got the ace of clubs. Following the club rules, Miss Lorne kills you. And this time, we make sure it looks like suicide.
I won't do it. I won't do it.
You'll do it. Only there's going to be one little change. One little difference tonight. After you kill Mr. Harris, after he commits suicide, you might say, you're going to commit suicide too.
What do you mean?
Let's all go into the kitchen and find out.
Why the kitchen?
That's where the stove is. The gas stove.
Oh, no. No.
Move, Miss Lorne.
No.
Lucas, you're being stupid. No. One suicide, the police will buy. But two...
You never heard of a suicide pact between lovers? Says so right here. See?
What?
That's the suicide note you're leaving. See? It's typed. But signed, Iris Lorne, Victor Harris.
Our signature? How did
they
you...
traced them. The contracts we signed.
No trick at all. Done it lots of times before. Once the cops read that, how she was on drugs and couldn't kick the habit, and you loving her so much you couldn't bear to see her go on suffering. Oh, they'll buy it all right, Mr. Harris. Just put the note on the table there, huh?
No, you...
No, no, don't, Mr. Harris. Don't try anything. One chop at the back of the neck. He'll be out for a long time. In fact, he won't be coming back. And now, Miss Lorne, turn on the gas.
No.
Miss Lorne?
I won't do it. I won't.
Drug her and drag her into his arms. Put his arms around her. Like so. Oh, good. All we need now is the gas.
Okay, Eddie. He's coming around. Hit her with the oxygen again. Okay, Mr. Harris. Snap out of it. Come on now.
What?
Breathe deep. Come on. Deep. That's the way.
Iris.
Now, she's coming around fine. Gotta be crazy. She'll just be okay, like you.
Lieutenant. McCree, isn't it?
Yeah.
How did you...
Well, I'm not as dumb as I look. Or act. Mr. Harris, I kind of put you on, you know? An act. Yeah. Throw a lot of characters off their guard that way.
Smith didn't fool you?
Nah, I fooled him. When that guy Lucas took me on a tour of the house, I saw a lot more than he thought I saw.
Well, what could you have seen?
That big round table in the middle of that big room. Oh, there's a vase of flowers on it and like that, but there's a circle worn in the rug around that table, and nobody admires flowers that much. Oh, yeah, I checked the sanitation boys and heard about the dozens and dozens of empty champagne bottles they pick up three times a week. All that plus the accidental death of Mr. Moffat that you described it. Oh, yeah, I checked up on that, of course. Anyway, all added up.
Well, you had us follow?
Oh, you and the lady have been tailed practically since you left headquarters.
Oh.
Okay, Eddie. Oh. Yeah, she's had enough. Come on, little lady. Come on.
Oh, what? Victor!
Well, she's going to be okay. By the way, Mr. Harris, you'll be glad to know we got a confession out of Lucas and Smith, and that's the end of the Suicide Club.
Well, it's the end of something else, too.
Yeah? What?
My compulsive gambling. I'll never make another bet as long as I live.
Victor Harris never did gamble again. The Suicide Club cured him of that. And oh yes, it cured Iris Lorne of drug addiction. Although I'm not so sure it wasn't having someone to live for, someone to love. You see, they're married now. As Victor Harris and Iris Lorne discovered, out of weakness can come strength, out of death, life. And compulsion is nothing more nor less than, as I said earlier, a decision we make within ourselves. We can decide for evil or for good, but it is always we who decide. Our cast included Les Tremaine, Jack Bibbins, Jim Dolan, Sandra Gare, Russ Reed, and Dick Thorne. Sound effects were by Kurt Mitchell, and our broadcast technicians were Rick Garofalo and Jim Zaromensky. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown. The Suicide Club was originally presented on the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, May 7th, 1974. This is Ken Lordine speaking. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
Wonderful cast, right? Marvelous cast. Sandra Gare, Les Tremaine, Jim Dolan, Russ Reed, Jack Bibbins, Dick Thorne, and Hyman Brown, and Kurt Mitchell. Why, there hasn't been so much basso profundo since the Lyric Opera came in here, I think. Now, I know you have a lot of questions to ask our cast. And, Russ, I know you've got to get out of here. There is a broadcast from the Pacific Garden Mission every week called Unshackled. And Russ Reed is a part of the cast this week, so I know he's going to have to get out of here. Thank you very much for being with us today, Russ. As I said before, after we get through with our Q&A session here, The cast members will be out in the lobby and will be glad to autograph something for you. For me, earlier this afternoon, these people autographed a copy of the original script of the CBS Radio Mystery Theater. When we first started working on this, Hyman Brown sent me a script for the show, and it was the actual script that was used back in 1974. It was a mimeograph script at the time. Today, what, computers and Xeroxing and all of that, was a mimeograph script, and then we made copies of that for our cast today. But I kept, you know me, I kept the original script, and I asked every one of the participants in our program today to autograph this. And next Saturday afternoon on our Those Were the Days program, we're going to offer that script plus a videotape of this event today to the highest bidder. So if you're interested, you can tune us in next week, and we'll see if we can't raise a few more dollars for the Radio Hall of Fame. And at that time, too, we'll tell you about how you can possibly get an audio cassette tape of this program today. Now, I know you folks have been working all day long. It started at 9 o'clock today, but they're willing to answer some questions. Who has some questions? This lady right here. Tell us your name and where you're from.
Mary Ann Polis. I live in Carpentersville. I noticed that at the earlier sessions, you know, that you cut some lines out of the material. And I don't know if I didn't pick it up, but I didn't notice you're adding anything. And I know that in an ordinary broadcast, you'd have to fit like a pine space. And I was wondering, like, who would do that? Who would then add things to make it come out right?
Today we don't have to really worry about timing, because with tapes, I come in afterwards and edit the shows. There were two or three places that I would want to edit tonight in the show that we just did. And I can come back and fix the tape very, very easily. And if it has to be 44 minutes and 30 seconds, it's timed to 44. It's a skillful job of editing with engineering and someone who knows about words. I did make some little cuts only for the sake of pacing. You listen to two or three times. The cast was new to me. The voices were new. They themselves gave me the pacing I wanted. So I did cut a little bit. So it was a little bit different than what you heard.
I do. Writer do it, or
no? No, I, as a producer director, would do it. Of course, when you read the credits on a movie or a Hollywood video or a Hollywood television show, there are 72 people who do it. I'm my own boss.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Elliot Cutler from Northbrook, and two things. One, if you could like hold up the script so you could see how it's organized on paper to be read by two separate people. And also, you mentioned before, how many of you worked with Orson Welles, and what was that like?
Well, I worked with Orson. I told you that back in 1933, he was, I don't know, 20 years old, and he was in Candida on Broadway, and he read poetry. And then when the Federal Theater Project came and the Mercury Theater Group with John Houseman, we all worked together very closely. It was a depression time. You must believe that when Orson did the Federal Theater, the actors worked 8 performances for $37 a week. A week. That was a lot of money in 1939. They could manage to pay their rent, at least. Food was another matter. But at 37, AFTRA came into being, the Actors Union, and a soap opera paid $33. Any soap opera that I did, like David Harum or John's Other Wife or Joyce Jordan, so they all worked for me. Orson, Everett Sloan, Agnes Moorehead, Mercedes McCambridge, the greatest actors and actresses that ever lived, all came out of radio. Dick Widmark, Van Heflin, legendary names, and they were all family. We all lived together.
He asked a question, Mr. Brown, about the how the script is organized so that two players speaking against one another, how it would work.
Well, that's just a matter of practice. One stands, I can read this way, or I can read this way. It depends. Two actors on a microphone. If you weren't with the audience, one actor would be working here, and one actor here, and then we read.
The script says John, and then it's the dialogue for John, then it says Mary, and the dialogue for Mary, then back to John, Mary, so forth. Going down, the third or fourth characters come in there. There's also sound, music.
You ought to display a script somewhere.
We'll try to do that.
Sure. The script you're gonna.
I'm fighting for a library, a print library for the Radio Hall of Fame. So somewhere along the line, we'll ask for more money. Question over here. Who's got a question? Gentleman over here. Yes, sir.
My name is Timothy Colgan. I'm from Chicago. I want to ask the sound effects man. I was a fan of Gunsmoke. How did they the background with the? It was almost like it was the wind blowing and the tumbleweed and stuff like that.
I worked only in Chicago. Gunsmoke, as to my knowledge, was not done in Chicago. I'm not that well acquainted. Jack Armstrong, Sky King, shows like that. Tom Mix. I did sound on those shows. And I'm sorry, I'm not acquainted.
Well, how would they make wind? Kurt?
Well, we had a wind machine. It was a motor with reeds, single reeds, long, thin, very, very thin pieces of wood mounted, and with a what we call a rheostat, you could vary the speed of it. And we connected it up to the AC current. And we had a great many sound effects on record, and quite a few eerie winds were already pre-recorded.
Did you ever have to do Horse and Hoofbeat?
Oh, yes.
Live?
That was...
How would you do...
I almost got cancer of the chest.
You want to be at risk for a second? How would you... let's hear a couple of...
Well, we had rubber cups, these plumbers, helpers, you know. you're all acquainted with those, you know. Usually on a stick. Take the stick off, then we put them on our chest.
Thank you. Question over here. We have a question.
I noticed Mr. Dolan changed his character substantially in the second take or the actual take. How much are the characters changed as the show would progress?
Oh, that would depend on the director. I would sometimes have the characters change because this was a new company to me. Reading it two times and then the third time, the actor himself or herself develops a feeling for the part. They had never seen this before this morning. And so nuances come in and developments happen. The great part in the glory days was casting the right actor for the right part. I would never cast Dick Widmark to play anything but kind of a semi-sinister type of menacing character, or a Van Heflin for anything but a hayseed loving young man who was after his girl. You cast properly, and then there isn't that much change. But it's like rehearsing for theater. You go through 2-3 weeks, and the character changes continuously, depending on the interrelationships of the players. The more you rehearse, the more there will be nuances in character changes.
Were there any actors in our cast today who started out, as you first read the script, with what you thought would be the voice you wanted to use, and then you changed it?
Yeah.
Les?
We all did.
You all did?
Yeah.
Jim, tell us.
Oh, I
come up, come up to the mic, Jim.
I'm still not sure that I like it.
Let's do it again.
Les, do you want to add something to that?
No, thank you.
Okay. I saw a hand right there. Has a hand over here. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Virginia from Chicago, and you all have magnificent voices, but I'd like to know what prompted Mr. Bevins and Mr. Nordine to start in radio. Did you go to school, or some would say you've got a great voice?
In my case, I got in a little play in grammar school, and there was a lady that ran a children's dramatic school downtown. And I ultimately ended up down there studying with her, and she would send the kids out on auditions for radio shows in those days. And as soon as I snagged the part for the first time, well, then my parents, I had to sign a 3-year contract with her to give her 10% of whatever I earned. And that's how I got started. I was 12.
How much were you earning? What did you earn, you remember?
At what point?
When you first started out.
Well, I was in dramatized commercials on Little Orphan Annie, and $35-$40. But then, as
for the week,
Hyman said, and the union came in.
Was that for the week?
No, I was getting that.
$35 for
every day.
Whenever you work.
Once in a while, right?
Now, when you were Chuck Ramsey on Captain Midnight.
Yeah.
What can you remember a line from that show that we might like to hear?
Blazing Beacon.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay.
My little son Chris, when he was in, I think, the third or fourth grade, they asked him, "What does your father do?" You know, they do that every now and then. He wrote, "My father never bothered to get a regular job." And he's a friend of doormen. Actually, what happened with me, I would get on the phone and talk with girls. And they'd say, "You have a nice voice." And I, after you hear that a couple of times, I said, "Hey, I think I'll go into radio." There was no TV at that time. And so I started with WBEZ here in Chicago, running the mimeograph machine and doing little plays with Sandra Gare and Jerry Coffer and Russ Reed, a lot of people. And the reason I took the job was so I could use the stationery to get a job in a real radio station.
Here's another question.
Roseanne Porter from Elgin. I just had a quick question. As was mentioned earlier, some of us born when we were not able to experience the golden age of radio firsthand. However, Mr. Brown, I really enjoyed Mystery Theater in the 70s and the 80s so much. And I was wondering if there's ever a chance, will it ever come back? Because I'm sure I'm not the only one that feels this way.
I'm in the process now of trying to get it syndicated again. It's difficult. Your media is responsible for radio and television, the people who pay for the commercials. Unfortunately, the media buyers are 28 to 35 years old. They don't know from radio except rock or news. They don't know what radio drama is. They really don't. It's shameful that they can't project themselves. I show them 350 stations. I show them 5 million listeners. Doesn't mean anything to them. The 17% commission that they get on selling a commercial spot for $800,000 on the Super Bowl, I could be on the air 2 years with that. So it doesn't pay for them, and they don't bother.
We have to try to do something about that, right? Yes, sir.
Don Anderson from Elmwood Park, Illinois. And I just want to say that in the 1980s, I drove a Buick and I drank Budweiser. So you were very effective in Radio Mystery Theater.
Okay. God bless you.
Here's a lady with a question.
My name is June Matha, and I'm here from Chicago. Mr. Brown said that he would tell us about sound effects with animals and birds. He promised.
The funniest story I can tell you about birds. There was a little man called Donald Bain. You got to know these who would do dogs, small dogs, and birds, and cats, and all sorts of things. And there was a time when I had to do a very special documentary script about smallpox, and it all took place the vaccine for smallpox in Panama, where we were digging the Panama Canal. And an incident to the doctors discovering the vaccine was the mosquito would. Played a part, and the mosquito at one point had to land on the hand of a soldier, sting the soldier. From that came the malaria disease, which hurts the soldier. So I had Donald Bain come in and play the mosquito. He wanted to know if the mosquito was male or female. But he was very intense about these things. We rehearsed, and I said, "Donald, I'm throwing a cue to the sound effects man, because at that point, you go bzzz, when I throw the cue to the sound effects man," and he slaps his hand, "you die." That's it. Well, we do the dress rehearsal, and he wasn't happy. He brooded. He went into a corner. He just couldn't stand the idea of the mosquito dying. We got on the air, and I understood. Because when I threw the cue to him to go, he went bzzz. Then I went to the sound man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other, I did Nero Wolfe for a long time, and Nero Wolfe was a fat man. And when I started to do Nero Wolfe, I said to myself, what is the sound of a fat man? Somebody did a program after I did it, and they had a scale, and you heard the scale, and I got on the scale, and somebody said, 300 pounds. That wasn't for me. And I said to Santos Ortega, who was the actor playing the part, I want you to do something for me. Would you laugh the way a fat man laughs? There is a special laughter for a fat, because it starts way down in the belly, you know. Ah, ah, ah. And that was my signature. And in those days, back in the 40s, your speakers had paper cones, if you remember. And the laughter had created a sympathetic overtone so that the paper rattled. So that not only did I get the laughter, but the rattle of the speaker said, Nero Wolfe is on the air. Sound is a critical, wonderful, wonderful weapon to use. My Bulldog Drummond signature, out of the fog, out of the night, with the foghorn going and the Big Ben going into his American adventure. They recently did Empire of the Air, a documentary about the beginning, and they used my signature without even saying, may we or may we not. But a lot of that goes. But I could go on for a long, another sound. I did Joyce Jordan's Girl Intern, if you remember. She was a girl intern for about 6 years. She's a good student, but not. At the end of 6 years, we had to change sponsors for whatever reason. And the new sponsor said, well, that's enough already, 6 years. So I made a Joyce Jordan MD. Now, this goes with a part of the story. I own very large motion picture stages, which for years have been under lease to CBS. And you remember when soap operas used to be half-hour shows. Now they're hour shows. But when they were half-hour shows, we did Guiding Light and All My Children or whatever. And you can't have a soap opera without operating rooms, without doctors. You want to get rid of a character in the show, into the operating room, and that's where they die, and so on. Both shows had their own operating room. They didn't use the same operator. You go into an operating room, they all look alike. You got the special lights, you got the special. No, each show had to have its own nurses, with support nurses, with anesthetists, etc. And Joyce Jordan, I did operations because she was a doctor, she was a surgeon, an assistant. All I needed was three things. I needed the beep beep, you know, the heart monitor, beep, beep, beep. And then I needed the thump, thump. That was easy because we took an actual stethoscope and put the microphone right on the heart and you got the thump, thump. So you had the thump, thump and the beep, beep. But what I really needed was an actor who could stand there and go, ah. Now, that's all. Two sound effects and one of the cast. Beep, beep, thump, thump. We did brain surgery before there was no brain. I did open heart. All you, and when I talk to you and you listen to me, I'm inside you. I become part of you because you're listening. No other form of theater has that. I said to you earlier in a little more polished way, it's listening. The joy of listening is what this is all about. I can't tell you how heartening it is to come here and see so many faces and to walk in and find a group of actors and technicians and sound people. Chuck, who prepared all of this so that my life would be a little easier. Les Tremaine, we were chatting 50 years ago, 1942-43, I cast them as Nick in Nick and Nora for The Thin Man. And we still talk to each other, we embrace each other. There's no other form. Look, it's a lifetime, and we're still here, and we will be as long as we enjoy what we're doing.
We have an audience who agrees with you very much. We have time for just a couple of more questions, and there's someone over here who has a question. Your name?
Chuck, while you're getting this person, you asked a while ago, or someone did, about how people build a character. Well, there are many stories about it, such as the beautiful ones that High has just told. There are thousands of stories about unusual incident in radio. I was doing Betty and Bob years ago. It was a soap opera, 1934-35. And one of our more or less regular character actors was a man named Frank Dane with a great background in theater and stock and so on. And he was having a little difficulty with his character. He was doing a double, as I remember. A double is when you play two parts. And you can't sound the same. You know, you've got to be different. Frank was having a little trouble with his double, and the director came up, took him by the shoulder, and he said, Frank, we've got to do something with this. It isn't quite right. Maybe in your mind, you could play him with a limp. Frank thought for a moment, mulled it over, and he said, which foot? That's how you build a character.
Okay, Kurt.
Speaking of characters, I have one character and one alone.
I'm King. All right, here's a question.
There seems to be a new generation of radio drama that I've recently come aware of. Mr. Nordine's Word Jazz, and there's other things being produced mainly on the East and West Coast. And I was wondering if any of you knew of some of these dramas or knew of anything coming up or anything that would be on the air in Chicago specifically, and if you're involved in any of this new radio drama.
Does anyone there know?
The oldest dramatic show still on the air. It's been on 43 or something like that years. And it's still on every week. There's a program called Unshackled, and it's sponsored by the Pacific Guard Mission, not too far from here, down at 646 South State Street. And every Saturday afternoon, if you'd like to see another show sometime, every Saturday afternoon they have some 150 to 250 people just show up and want to see it. And so there's another avenue of dramatic shows that you might want to visit sometime. The audience gets there around 4 in the afternoon, and they start doing the show around 5.
To address your question specifically, I'm not aware of anything new coming forward in the Chicago area as far as original radio drama is concerned. But what we're doing today is the beginning of what the Radio Hall of Fame can do. We hope in the near future to be able to do something like this on a regular basis, to be broadcast, hopefully in the Chicago area and throughout the country on stations that will have us. We know it's hard to find the spot. I mean, High Brown has said this, it's so difficult to find the spot on so many stations in spite of the following that you can have. But if we can find some spot on some stations, and we can do this and we can get the backing, and we need sponsorship, and if we can do that, we're going to do it. And we're not going to wait for someone to come knocking on our door. We're going to try to find people who will support this sort of thing. And then we can have talented people like this come in, do a great job like this, and even get paid for it.
The whole country is in the same position. Radio was killed, literally, in the United States, by the people who wanted television. There was more money to be made in television. It was very difficult because radio was so ingrained with the public. The public didn't want to give it up. But if it was taken away from them, there's nothing they could do. Now, on a brighter note, we have been doing a series of rep company shows. A repertory theater is where you perhaps are the star one week and you play the Iceman the next week, or you play a lesser character. It gives everybody a chance to display his talent and so on. In California, we now have an outfit called California Artists Radio Theater. It was started and is produced and directed by a young lady named Peggy Weber, who has a good background in theater. She's been doing this for years, and she also has a great background in radio. And we do fine things, Shakespeare. I'm doing Polonius and Hamlet very shortly. And in this country, we've never had a chance. People my age never had a chance to play Shakespeare. It wasn't a thing that you did in this country. You had to go to England, really, to do any Shakespeare. We've done Shaw. We've done Wilde, Oscar Wilde. I was so pleased to be able to do Ernest and the Importance of Being Earnest, which is a delightful play, social commentary. So, what we are trying to do is build an audience, and it is very difficult. We're on a public broadcasting station, and I understand we are being played all over the country now in strategic areas. But it is very difficult to bring radio back, and any of us who try to bring it back, please support us as you people have tonight. Spread the word, because it could be brought back on a lesser level than it used to be. But I know the public would be with us if we could do it. Thanks to all of you for having come here today. We appreciate it.
I know you have many questions. We promised we would wrap it up here by 3:30 at the latest, and we do want to have some time for autographs, and maybe you can ask individual questions of some of our cast members when you get the autograph. But I have a man here who's been dying to get my attention.
My name is Paul Ifta. I'm from Romeoville. I remember when I was about 13, 14 years old, my dad took me to WMAQ at the Merchandise Mart, Studio A, and Les Tremaine played on First Nighter, if my memory serves me right. It was a small stage. Some of the people I actually heard tonight, and I was talking to the sound effects man. Remember being the stage, only a platform, and I was so disappointed when I walked in and saw just a foot-high platform, a lot of folding chairs, about 5 mics in the front of the stage. Mr. Mitchell's equipment was off to the right, about 3 or 4 turntables, and his other equipment, the doors and whatnot, and the director's booth was on the left-hand side. And I don't remember your voice. I've heard it so much in the past, but I just wanted to let you know, I do remember those beautiful days when we had such great radio here in Chicago. I was talking to Chuck last week about the Crime Files of Flamand on WGN Radio that a lot of people don't talk about or hear about anymore. And it's nice, it's so nice to see you and talk with you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's one of the nice things about radio. It was never impersonal. As High Brown said, it was part of all of you. You were living what we were doing inside yourselves. There's another thing about radio. We had some tremendous actors and actresses in the medium. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to performers. Here we were in the Depression, very deep in the Depression. I worked for 8 months in radio before I made a cent. And then I made $5 for one show and $7.50 for another, for the same director the same day. And I was a rich man. I made $12.50 that day. The wonderful thing in those days for all of us was the fact that for the first time, and if you had worked in stock on the road and so on, you never knew when the producer or the director, I beg your pardon, sir, would abscond with the night meter funds from the box office. And if you wanted to get out of town, you had to throw your trunk out the window if you were rich enough to have a trunk and run for your life, because they were after you. Actors had a terrible reputation. For the first time in history, honestly, actors could stay in one town, they could get married, they could have a family, they could get a AAA credit rating, which was unheard of except for a very few, and lead a normal life and become pillars of society in their community. It truly was the greatest thing that ever happened to people. I don't mean to be personal, but I was as poor as anybody could be when somebody told me, look, with your voice, you ought to get into radio. And I almost said, radio, what's that? You know. But we were all so lucky to be able to partake of this particular phase of show business. And I had done it all before that. It was great.
Because we're going to meet outside, I'd like to give Kurt and you one of my secrets. Anybody can do it.
Sandra?
I just want to say it never pays to give up. Don't ever give up. In 1944, when I got into radio, the two people that I wanted to meet most were Les Tremaine and Hi Brown. And I came into Chicago as Les Tremaine was leaving for Hollywood. And of course, I wasn't in, I guess, Hollywood, in New York or California when Hi Brown was there. Here they are. Here they are, 40 what? How many years later? And I finally met them both.
I know what she's talking about. When I was a kid, on my knees, on my stomach, on the floor, in front of that Zenith console radio with the flickering green eye and the lightning letters written across the dial, I never dreamed that I would listen to the man who entertained me on the first nighter program. I never dreamed I would listen one day in the same room to hear words about radio from the man who created the creaking door of the inner sanctum. And I suspect that maybe none of you did either. But today, we did it. And thank you very much for coming. It's been a great afternoon. And thank all of you for being with us today on our Radio Hall of Fame recreation. Now our cast is going to be down. If they can get through, I'll be out signing some autographs out front. And thanks so much for being here. Yeah.